Ah.
Good.
You're better at this than I am.
So that's what we call the discussion?
Yeah, because there are multiple authors. There are a bunch of people back at Stony Brook that are also authors, and I want them to be able to hear the comments on the paper.
And how shall I put it? Our communal brain droppings are so fragrant. All right. I nominated myself to be the guy who goes to the whiteboard and does the stuff. All right, so let me start.
This is a lot of fun. I really enjoyed this.
Yes, you that was really great.
They'll like to hear that.
Okay. Shall we pin this up a little bit more so it's not in the way? You can always undo the pins later, but I think we're going to need the space.
I'm going to do the other one.
Okay, so first, there is a lot of silly hype out there over the idea that simulations represent some kind of a new science. And so Patrick at the beginning puts a nice negation operator. Right. And so obviously I approve of that very much. And I looked at Wolfram's book and I just thought it was bizarre. And the impression that I got is here's a guy who spent I don't know how many years of his life building up computer software, doing all these sort of simulations, and it was something I said this morning in the seminar. If you're a guy with a big hammer, everything looks like a nail. Right? So that's the only sense that I could make of what he was doing. Okay, I was able to get three major claims out of the section of the paper that you got us to read. I read those carefully, and I skimmed through the rest. And let me go through, and I'll add comments while I go. So the first claim is the idea that there is a continuum of modeling. This is a way of locating the activity of computer simulation within a larger structure. And at one end, you have abstract formal theories, and at the other end, you've got concrete physical models. So the abstract formal theories are Newton's mechanics. The concrete physical models at the other end are things like wind tunnels and the like. And then sitting in between, you've got the computer simulations. Right. And the idea is that the computer simulations partake of elements of both. The computer simulations employ the abstract formal systems in their constructions, right? You've got, as it were, the propositional content there goes into the simulation. But at the same time, the concrete physical, there's a connection with the concrete physical models in that computer simulations are running in material systems, and the properties of the material systems and how they evolve then becomes important. Now, I had sort of more comments than summaries, and so if you don't mind, what I wanted to do was just to go directly into the comments. Is that okay with you? The first thing that I wanted to say about this is, I thought that when you look at it that way, computer simulations are much closer to the abstract formal theories on the other end, because in the end, simulation at its heart really is a set of propositions. I mean, literally it will be in the code, right? right? You'll have some kind of propositional content in virtually every bit of code that you write. And the simulation part is only coming about because of our inability to see the consequences of that propositional content, right? So I thought there's a lot, you know, on this way of representing things, you're getting very much closer to the abstract formal theory side, and then correspondingly, I think you're more distant here because the physical properties are relatively unimportant. I mean, what really matters in a computer is very, very little. The physical system have binary states, for example, or maybe the chip can simulate arithmetic, and then after that, all of the work is being done right by the formal properties that you're imposing on it. You really have a tremendous independence. You know, you can realize computers in all sorts of physical materials. So anyway, I thought things are really, really very much more over towards that end. And you know, I began to think at what, you know, when you set up the computer simulation, some people actually don't need to do the computer simulation. I've noticed a degradation of analytic skills over the generations. As we now have more computing power, people can do less stuff. I'm very good at looking at the formula for a function and telling you what the function looks like asymptotically. I notice that that a lot of people in generations coming after me have to program the thing into a computer and then see what happens, mm-hmm. right? And so there's something about the division between the two that is really dependent on our cognitive abilities. I wouldn't really like for there to be a major difference here that simply comes out of our cognitive ability. You know, clearly the essence of it is going to be the propositional content. And so that's a worry. That's a worry.
Okay.
Put it over there. All right. Now, next thing is just got to be a bit careful, I think, about this use of the word continuum. So that's one point. I mean, it has a meaning, right? And so the obvious question is, if you're talking about a continuum, you want to know are there transitional forms? The idea is that for any point here, point there, you can always find something in between. And so what are the, you know, and I think the word continuum is not completely wrong, but the idea being that there are gradations in between. But it does suggest that you ought to be thinking pretty carefully about what the transitional forms are looking like. How much can you push that, you know, computer simulation mm-hmm. over towards abstract or computer simulation in the other direction? So I started thinking up a few examples, and something mm-hmm. that is close to the abstract end for a computer simulation might be something like this. Let's say when you do a graphical solution of an equation, right? You're still getting the result out by a formal method, but it's by a simulation method. You're actually using the properties of the paper, as it were, almost to do it. But it's getting pretty far away from the inner workings of it are no longer mysterious and hidden to you, right? And people might not identify that as a simulation technique at all. So I thought getting over in that direction, you've got... I don't think it's a very good example. But getting over to this end, and now making some trouble for this idea that the physical properties of the system are relatively unimportant, are computer simulations using analog computers.
Hmm.
They go back a long way. People don't use them anymore because they're not worth the trouble. But I'm still old enough to have actually learned how to program an analog computer. And there, in a digital computer, what the material gives you is just binary properties, on or off, and then you have a whole bunch of gates. With an analog computer, the material itself is actually able to give you the instantiation of differential equations. And the basic unit...
So if you put digital and analog on there, you'd put digital closer to the left and analog further toward the right.
Digital would live here, an analog would live there, because the hardware, the physical properties of the hardware, gets to be more important when you get closer to over here. I'm now trying to remember what the hell analog computers function like, but in place of a binary gate in an analog computer, you have an integrator. I think that was the basic trick.
Yeah,
you had,
I never worked with them.
I think that's the basic thing. So the unit is this gizmo that integrates. And once you can integrate, you could do everything else. I don't recall that we had anything that did differentiation.
You've got like dials that you're. It's like a radio dial. It's analog in the way that an old style radio dial.
It's analog in the sense that the input is going to be a continuously variable voltage, and the output will be a continuously variable voltage.
Right.
The components sit on a board, and to program it is you wire it up. You literally connect up the components with wires, and then you look at the voltage going in, and you look at the voltage going out. It's that's pretty serious stuff. Okay, and then just this is just a tangential remark, but it's worth noting that real theorists or real scientists aren't so bothered to worry about the clean division between formal theories and simulations and this and that. They just want to get a result out. So there's an enormous amount of practice that just mushes all this together. Okay, so... Scientists mix. I don't know so many examples, but it's not something I've worked on, but I talked about the Ising model, and you get a lot of its properties out of simulation. But to begin with, it's straight theoretical analysis. You do straight statistical physics. You set up a Hamiltonian. You solve it. There's the simple two-dimensional Ising model that Ising had, I think, in the 20s. I don't remember when exactly the details. That can be solved exactly. Then you go to more complicated models. You can't solve them anymore, but you've got pretty good hunches. And then you start to move over into the simulation. You're just bouncing backwards and forwards between simulation and the like. Anyway, so that might be. I don't know what that means about practice. But it's certainly there. All right, that's first guy. Now let's go on to the second.
Can I ask a question about that section? One of the things we've worried about is there's a sentence in there that says something about legislating in a small amount or something, because we end up talking about simulations as being essentially single runs of models.
That was your definition.
Yeah.
I saw that.
Did that jar? Did that seem like, ooh, that didn't like run ice up your spine or anything?
Here it is. Legislating only slightly, we will use computer simulations as a count noun to refer to specific runs of such computer models.
And that didn't like jar. Okay.
Page two.
All right.
That didn't bother me. I highlighted it. I underlined it because
Okay.
Because I've got to know what you mean when you say. The key thing here is that the word is being used in the plural.
Yes.
If you had said computer simulation.
No, and all the way through we use simulation as like modeling, you know. It's something you do, and it's not tied to a... Okay, all right. I wanted to know whether that jarred.
You know, I don't know if we...
I think people's usage is, in fact, quite variable and loose in this. I don't think anybody like strictly goes, that's not a simulation, that's a model. Or, you know, that's not just a model, that's a simulation. I don't think anybody talks like that. I think it's more wavy gravy than that.
Could it be that these terminological uncertainties are at the heart of the debate whether this is all new or not? I mean, what's his name?
Are these guys who think it's all new?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the Archimedes and his bath as a simulation. I mean, if they would have the same notion of a simulation, I mean, they wouldn't say
they wouldn't
it's new. I mean,
well, not a computer simulation. I mean, certainly Archimedes wasn't a computer simulation. They, I think, do tend to think of simulation as strictly computer simulation, and it is new, but it's because computers are new. But they also act as if this very thing that you're doing is like a new cat. There's the inductive, there's the deductive, and there's this, you know, and that's what we're trying to.
Okay, but
so
when you speak of simulation, you mean the whole spectrum, like.
I think what we're tied to is modeling. At least is the whole spectrum. Simulations are when you take a particular model in there and you go, oh, well, let's set its variables as this, or let's solve the equations with dropping in these things, or let's do the physical model with something cubical in the wind tunnel instead of something spherical. Each time you do that, it's a simulation.
So Griggs and Watson's DNA modeling would be a physical simulation, right?
That's interesting. I don't know. Let me think about it. And we've also worried about the word model being so widely used that we were going to gain nothing and lose lots by using it. And there's this quote that we referred to in a footnote, but we haven't found again. It's this horrible quote from Nelson Goodman, because it was written in the 60s or something, and Nelson Goodman is saying, models is used everything. Models could mean anything from a set of equations to a blonde.
Models certainly can, I'll pass on the blonde stuff, but models certainly can mean sets of equations. That's a standard use.
Yes, but the problem was maybe it can mean all just about everything else, too. And we wondered, like, is the Bohr model of the atom a model in the sense we're talking about? And is the DNA model a model? Is the Watson-Crick model a model? Or the Pauling model a model in the sense we're talking about? And I'm not sure, just because it is standardly called a model, it's this kind of thing where you can set different parts of it and see what happens.
Can I say something at this point?
Yeah.
I had a concern when reading the paper that, well, it's completely intuitive, I know nothing about it, but it seems to me that something important in simulation is that you have to choose certain parameters or the one which are relevant. And you come to this point on the later on the question of failures,
yes,
and failures of correspondence, etc.
Yes.
But I had the intuition that it's important for defining what is simulation, and that it could have been mentioned
that
before.
It should have been said better.
Yeah.
More
upfront. Or if
okay.
It's relevant or not. And it seems to me it has something to do with what you've just said, the difference between simulation and modeling and the relationship between
or
the
different
two.
Senses of models.
Yeah, so maybe that should be
okay.
Precise at the beginning.
But it's actually relevant to John's points here in the beginning, that there is this distinction between models as sets of equations and models as like physical models. And given that division, actually, computer simulation, I think John is right, will be on the
I take his point. I think, and to the extent that we ever say computer simulation is right in the middle, I think that's a mistake. You know, and I also take his point on continuum, that unless we really want to mean all the standard properties of the continuum, we should look for something sloppy, a spectrum or range.
I mean, it's right and it's wrong, what you're saying. It's exactly right, because it indicates we don't have this clear three-way division. Don't think that it's going to be blurring. But it's also wrong because, you know, we're philosophers and we're used to words having precise meanings, and continuum is not is more than just dense.
Yes.
Things
right.
That, you know.
Right.
Even if Carnap does have, Carnap has the continuum of inductive methods, and there is a real valued parameter, is there not?
Okay. All right.
So he's okay.
And I couldn't hand you anything like that here.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, no great harm's done. But why might misuse the term so that people who aren't as sensitive to the true meanings of it. All right. Okay. Let me go on, because there are three major theses, and I want to get to number two. And then this was, I thought, a lovely systematization of the way that simulations are used. The idea was to distinguish four uses: prediction, explanation, postdiction, and emergence explanation. Right? And in order to be able to say something about how they differed, you identified three elements in any simulation: the input, the mechanism that's then used to generate the output. And using that, you could then sort of categorize everything using binary characters. So for prediction, you know the input, you know the mechanism, but you don't know the output. But for explanation, you know the input and the output, and you want to find the mechanism that gets you there. right? For post-diction, you know where things end up at the output, you know the mechanism, and so you infer back to what the input was, the obvious examples being inferring back to, you know, some past event that that brought about, I don't know what, the extinction of the dinosaurs. We know there aren't any dinosaurs around now. Okay, and then finally there are emergence explanations where you know the way things are now, but you don't know how they started or what the mechanisms is, and you try and figure that out. The example you give is Conway's life, wanting to show that a very simple system can manifest complicated structures. Now, I thought actually here, exploratory uses, you had a reason for why you didn't want to include them in the in the system, but I thought the only reason was it happens not to be easy to attach check marks to
they don't fit. That's
true. Don't fit, but it's a very, very important usage for simulations.
But I would tend to say it's an important usage across all of them.
Yeah, that's what you say
in the
paper.
Okay.
It seems important that.
But don't lose them.
But it's like it's not a fifth column. No. It's like sometimes these things are in demonstration form, and sometimes they're just noodling around trying to figure out what kind of input conditions could give you this kind of thing. And then they're being the same. You're looking for the same kind of thing, but you're not being rigid. You're like trying things. You're being exploratory.
Exploratory would then be a means to attain one of these four goals, so to say.
Or it would be exploratory with this kind of structure. Like you'd be exploring, what kind of input conditions, this is the mechanism, if this is the recognized there aren't any more dinosaurs around, what kind of thing could have produced that? And you might, you might be trying things seat of the pants and not very formally and, here's formal run number one, here's formal run number two. But you'd still be following that structure. That's the idea.
So exploratory will not get you to a new discovery, radical discovery?
Oh, yeah, it might well.
Discovery.
Yeah,
so
it might well. But if it does, it'll be in one of those structures.
For example?
What do you got?
It doesn't matter. We'll get to that in a moment.
Okay.
No, it's just that one of the things that happened when computer simulation became available was that suddenly you could do things you could never do before, and you could investigate the properties of systems that you couldn't investigate analytically. And so, and it's done in all these different ways. So, I mean, they're used in crazy places where you wouldn't expect it. People simulate black holes in general relativity. So black hole coalescence, you get to, what happens when two black holes approach one another? Right. Well, actually, solving analytically the behavior of two approaching black holes is one hell of a thing. So they do numerical simulations on this to get the results. They don't know what's going to happen. They're going to, it's real exploration. And of course, then the difficulty is when you get some particular behavior out of this, you've used up all your computer time to do one run, and you want to know: was this an artifact of the particular data I put in, or is this really generically what's going to happen? I just wanted to respond to what you had one remark in here. I couldn't find it afterwards. You had in and out as always temporal states earlier and later, and the question was: are there any non-temporal ones? And the answer is yes. Sure, there are plenty of them. Here's just one very common example, and that is. If you're an engineer building a bridge or a building, you want to know what the stresses look like in the building, and there's no need to compute it analytically. You just go ahead and do it. Now, but all I want to say is don't worry about it because the structure of input and output is going to remain the same. The input is going to be, here's a bridge. I know that these are fixed points here. And they're going to hold up the weight of the bridge, so I know that there's a reaction force here of such and such. And then the output, the mechanism is then using a simple forces model, vector addition of forces. And from that, you'll figure out how the stresses will be distributed through all the members. I think I've seen engineers talk about the flow of stresses through there, so there's a kind of implicit temporal model there.
That's good, because our suspicion was, no, they don't have to be temporal,
no.
Although the examples that we sort of immediately came up with were. And, we'd want to call it input and output, even if it's not like...
You can. I don't think it'd be any... And you'll find a bunch more examples that look like that. I was thinking, I don't know enough of what goes on in quantum chemistry, but I'll bet that not everything that's simulated is a reaction. I would think simply, a stable molecular structure, just asking, what does a benzene ring look like? Can we set up and solve that? Right? And they're not asking what happens to a benzene ring when you, when you hydrogenate it or something. Right? So no, there are other cases. All right. So far, so good. And then part three. Now here, this was the third part, and I thought this is where the most work is needed. It looks like you were losing energy. And the contrast that you made was the following. You had this idea that experiments include, real parts of the world, okay, whereas simulations imitate. Okay, so there's a big contrast there.
And that setup is something we're trying to sort of knock down.
Oh, you are? Okay, good. I was just going to tell you knock it down, basically. But let me finish. And so an issue that comes out of this is if you're imitating, there's an issue of correspondence. And a lot of effort went into the talk about correspondence. You had another, not a continuum, but you had a spectrum. All right. Okay, it's a strategy of dealing with stuff that went all the way from identity through, you're asking, what does that correspondence consist in? Right? Well, it could consist in identity, it could consist in functional equivalence. I think, is that a fair enough way of saying
yes.
The functional equivalence?
Yes.
Okay.
That's good.
All the way down to pure in interpretation. Okay, so a whole bunch of comments on this. The first comment is, yes, occasionally, all right, occasionally this will be correct, that experiments are truly including. But in fact, experiments are always relying on some sort of imitative power of the material. Even in the cases that you think are most secure, they're still relying on imitative power. So think about what seems very secure, a wind tunnel. Right? Well, what you have in a wind tunnel is a scale model, and you have to do scaling. And you have to have some confidence that what happens on the scale of the wind tunnel will be reproduced on the larger scale. And that is actually, I can now tell you, engineering, that's actually a difficult thing to get right, because different things scale in different ways. Right? So, you just think about the scaling of insects up to human size. The strength goes up with the square of the size, the weight goes up with the cube of the size. So if you try and scale up an insect to be human size, they break their legs when they try and stand up. Or if you try and scale a human or a gorilla to be the size of King Kong, King Kong can't stand up without breaking his legs because the weight of King Kong has vastly outstripped the strength of the legs. And so very often what happens in the scaling is that the different things scale differently. And there's one very vivid example of that you might have noticed. You ever watch these cheesy pirate movies from the 50s and the 60s? Yeah, you have. They're great fun. And they always photograph scale models. Now, one of the things they have to do is slow things down because time is one of the things that has to be scaled when you go to a smaller... So something doesn't just plop into the water. It's falling, supposedly 50 feet, so it's got to take a while to get down there. Whereas in the model, of course, it will just go like that. But the waves. Yeah, it's the fluid properties of the water that don't scale well. Mm-hmm. The surface tension of the water is going to be completely wrong.
Fire is bad too.
Yeah, okay. But that's a classic example. Mm-hmm. Okay, but so no matter what you're doing, any real experiment short of the real thing itself is going to have some kind of imitative experiment, unless you just get everything exactly the same. And even then, you're making an assumption, although now a completely innocuous assumption, that doing exactly the same thing again will give you the same result. You're there assuming that there's no cosmic, aging, with time. Now, this has been discussed a lot in the literature. I can just mention, I know two people who write on this. One is Wendy Parker, who is presently at Ohio U. So if you guys come to the Quadrennial Conference, you'll meet her there. And she's done some wonderful stuff that really emphasizes this. In fact, it's quite neat. It can turn out that a computer simulation can be a better way to go than a concrete physical model, right? Exactly because the assumptions needed to make the concrete physical model work are less reliable than what you can do with a
wonderful
computer simulation.
Great.
And the big example of that is meteorology, right? It turned out to be hopeless very early on to get big tanks of moist air and try and use them, or big tanks of water and try and use them to simulate the atmosphere. It just doesn't work. Now, Wendy knows this very well because she's a meteorologist, so you get lots of stuff on that. That was the first one. And then the second thing, this is not my area, but Mehmet, you might know about this. Brad Wilson has written a lot about experiments in ecology, in biology. And there's a real question as to whether what you do in the confines, you get a fish sticking in a tank, is that really the way the fish is going to behave if you put it in a mountain stream, right, where all the extra pieces are there? And so there's a real issue as to, you would think, it's just a fish, you're going to attack, what does it want? What does it know? Well, it knows a lot, and there are going to be problems. Okay, so I thought, this include stuff is far more dangerous than it looks.
Okay,
I had a sense that you were going there, by the way, all the way through. So.
Yeah, but I think you're encouraging us to be bolder in doing it because we set up going, well, this is what people say about simulations. Real experiments are real and simulations are just fake. Okay, all the difference between real and fake. Then we were trying to peg away at that. But our claims that, this holds for experiments too, all of that ended up in the footnotes. And
yeah.
You say,
it was slowly building, but it didn't build fast enough.
I'm actually very surprised that John Maynard Smith made this comment. surprising that this John Maynard Smith.
Yes, he did.
He was very skeptical about computer simulations,
yes.
And he's the guy who spent his life building theoretical models in biology.
Absolutely.
I'm very surprised.
Well, that's another area where, although you see these two things as very close on the left-hand side, economists don't. So there is like a fracture in many economics departments where the old-style analytic equation guys think that this computer stuff is just like phony baloney. It's what all these young guys do. And there's like, they see this real tension there.
Wow.
That's
true. Really interesting. That sounds like a generational artifact.
Because
I don't see there's any basis in the material. In fact, they're much better off doing what I suggested down here, mix it up. Solve analytically when you can. You're always better off if you can do that.
Yeah.
But all right, so let me keep going. I'll just flat out. I really didn't like the spectrum. You'll have to forgive me. I just thought identity at the other end, it's not a simulation anymore. And at the other end, when you had pure interpretation, remember the idea was that all of the work was being done by the interpreter. You had hesitant remarks there, and I just want to say, yeah, boy, be hesitant about this. Because if you're really doing that, it won't work. I mean, you can't just use interpretation to.
Yeah, I didn't understand.
You know,
at all.
to get results out.
Yeah.
So anyway,
I
could see you guys knew that, but I'm just telling you, what you knew is right. Okay, but there's another remark
now,
that I want.
The identity thing, however, the claim there would be that in at least some cases the correspondence was identity, not in that the simulation was identical to the reality, but that properties of the simulation were the properties in the reality.
Well, you had the example of artificial life for that, right?
Yeah.
That was the idea. And certainly right now, if your focus is artificial life, that you're not simulating, it is it. But if you think you're learning about the way wet life is, then it's not. So
right.
Maybe there's room to debate this further, but it needs a little more work. If you could somehow establish that you can have identity and simulation at the same time, uh, I'd sit up and take notice. That would be something.
I thought the idea was that the identity has to do with the relevant factors, but it might differ in many other ways. Right?
Yes,
that's
like scale being one.
Yes, yes, but that you might be spreading from agent to agent. You might be trying to study something in the real world that does spread from agent to agent. In your simulation, something different, something artificial, spreads from agent to agent, but they both spread, and you know that's where the identity thing would be. However, when we came to, we thought we've got to say something about correspondence, since that's sort of the area that people raise, that raises people's hackles about right. simulation, is problems of correspondence. We didn't find ourselves saying, oh, well, obviously, correspondence is always blank. So we started off going, well, what are some, like, positions with regard to what that correspondence could be? And maybe we can just lay out a bunch of positions and not decide the issue for now. And when we did that, we ended up saying, well, maybe these aren't, like, opposing positions. Maybe there are different kinds of correspondence that appear in simulation, so it's not, oh, it's always this, as if correspondence were always one thing. But
that's really a good thought, that there are different sorts of correspondence. I agree with that, and I don't know what they are, but that's got to be right.
I mean, all those examples you gave in the thing, couldn't you go back and try to say which one of them would be in the three? Like the modeling of the failure of the 17th Street levee, that would
right.
be identity, I would take it, right? Because most of the features in the simulation were real, I guess it was real dirt.
It was real dirt and real water,
and
but
levees.
The scaling thing wasn't the same. And it may be contestable whether, but yes, they were trying to have some things be the same. They wanted the relative scale of the particles at the base of the levee to the particles at the top of the levee, that proportion to be exactly
mm-hmm.
what was in
right.
the simulation. So the proportion was supposed to
right.
match.
Yeah, they've
got to
be really
identical.
Careful with it. You've got the fully human sized analog there. It's not obvious that you should maintain the same shape when you do that.
Right.
You've got to do the sums to figure out what the right simulation. Okay.
Maybe it's like you can have simulation by increasing the complexity and making it more to the realistic side, and by abstracting away, making it more to your intuition about this pure interpretation stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah.
So it includes some more features of reality that will make it more complex and toward the side of identity.
Well, that's going to be true too. I mean, yes, there are going to be different simulations that are more abstract or closer to the thing, because there are, in some intuitive way, there are more things that match in this one than there are in this one. I'm not sure that's all that's at issue. I think it's true that there are different kinds of correspondence, that some of them you're trying to duplicate the property, some of them, no, you're trying to duplicate the functional relationship mm-hmm. between the parts of the model to the thing. But boy, I wish we had something better to say there. I'm with you. I wish we had something better to say there.
I think what Ed said is a good strategy. Go back and look at particular models, because I'll bet you you'll start to see different sorts of correspondence. I don't know, claims or postulates or assumptions
mm-hmm.
or I don't know quite what they're gonna look like. We could if we have time, we could throw up a few examples and see if we can cook something up.
The artificial life one is that like dealing with like a computers like a
yeah that may not be yeah
that would
that
be more like functional, wouldn't it? Because
yeah, I think the truth of it is yes, and I think the sober practitioners of artificial life, yes, they're looking for things as objects in a program that dance the way components of a living organism dance. They're trying to match the dance, okay? And when you think of simulating molecule formation or protein formation, that's exactly what you're doing. You're trying to get little geometrical things that follow rules that will give you something predictable in them. The quotes, which maybe we should just drop, were by sort of wild-eyed, crazy early guys trying to put together artificial life who literally said, artificial life is just one kind of life. It's not like a false pregnancy, which isn't a kind of pregnancy at all. No, no. Artificial, there's life that's in wetware, and there's life that literally is in your computer, that those little guys dancing around on the screen are alive. Now, it's a crazy position. I mean, and they didn't need to argue. It's one of those flag-waving, oh, yes, they got a lot of attention, and then the serious guys came in and got the clowns off the stage. But, but you know, it was one of those.
Just a matter of commentary. This is expository only. If you look at the way you've written this particular section, you actually have two questions about correspondence. One is an epistemic question. How could you know whether there is a correspondence? And the other is a semantic question. What does it mean to say there is one? And in an effort to kind of get people interested in the semantic question, you pose the epistemic question and then just ran them together. You've got to pull them apart.
The background of that is I think it was originally written semantically, and my co-authors wanted to push the epistemic. Yeah, they ought to be listening.
Just the plug sign I've been into, you could also call it structural, the middle position, because it's not so much the identity elements, it's the configurations, relationships between them. And is there an isomorphic relationship between the relationships in the real world to the model that you've constructed? You know, I always think of Wittgenstein's claim in the Tractatus that music
on a staff?
Yeah, on a staff. Musical notation on a staff mimic or is structurally identical to the sound wave, you know, and so that would be
that's
a classic example,
that's a nice example
of how two things are totally different, right? Dots on paper and sound waves in the air, but the one has somehow has a structural relationship that can get you back the other one, you know, which is really interesting.
Okay, I had two comments I wanted to make. The first one is this: you really got me thinking about just what is scientific theorizing, and the question of whether you can really separate out abstract formal theories from computer simulations. You know, people tend to think of them as very separate activities, but I think I'm agreeing with you guys. It never has been that separate. And here's, I think, an example that looks as safe as any example could ever be. This is a classic bit of physics, goes back, I guess, to the 17th century. This is the harmonic oscillator. Right. You know, that's the setup. You've got an anchor point, a hook spring, and a mass that oscillates. Set up Newton's laws of motion, right? And it becomes x double dot plus kx is zero, right? Where k is the spring constant, unit mass, right? And then what's the final step? The final step is with appropriate boundary conditions, you solve it, and you get x is sine square root of t, right? That looks like just pure formal analysis. But in fact, it's not, right? And this is why it's not. You see, it's this last equation here. You solved it. But actually, when you realize what you're doing in the mathematics, that solution is nothing more than an indirect way of saying, oh, x is the function that solves that equation with such and such boundary conditions. That's in effect, you know, what is sine? The sine function is a function whose values can only be ascertained by looking them up in a table. Right, and so in effect, you're saying, so now, if you want to know what x will be at a particular time, go and look it up in a table. But where do you think the table came from? The table came from exactly the sort of activities that you do there. I mean, ever since the time of Newton, right? These tables are generated by numerical methods. Okay, that says, go to table. Right, made by numerical methods. And, you know, the methods of building tables have been developed for over hundreds of years, and they are the same techniques that you use up there, or methods for solving differential equations are just reborn as methods of computer simulation. The standard, what used to be a course in techniques for solving differential equations numerically now becomes a course in computer simulation. That was the first question, and then the second question is it's a very open one. You know, so the question is, what sort of, you know, what boundaries are there really between those activities? Why isn't the simulation activity buried in the formal stuff all along? We just, you know, and then the next question is, you know, what is the killer question? This is a more diffuse thought, and that is, you know, we're looking at a field of study that's getting its feet. Okay, for a long time, people have had this idea, you know, we're noticing computer simulations are immensely important. They keep coming up in science all the time. The practice of science overtly uses them more and more and more. Philosophy of science is stuck back in a mode that was, you know, that maybe made sense about 50, 100 years ago, but we're not taking enough notice of this. So our field ought to be embracing this. That's why I applaud the project. Now, the interesting thing, if you look about the dynamic of our discipline, is that it thrives on one of these killer questions, the killer conundrum, where people's intuitions hive off in opposite directions, and then we engage. It's the sort of question that has to be solved by philosophical methods, right? I don't know what it is here yet, but I'd love to see it. You know, there are examples that go across the difference. You know, in biology, for example, are there any laws in biology? Right, that's a great one, because people's instincts go off in different directions, and they, you know, right, it's a great topic, and you can go across the different sciences and find these in general philosophy of science. You have similar things. Look at the fuss that GRU created, right?
That's,
you know, now here, I think the really creative work is to come up with a killer question. There are some candidates for it. But I'm not sure that they aren't somehow tired. One of the obvious candidate is this: simulations aren't real because they merely imitate. But that seems to produce more of a kind of a sigh. It's not as though two very well-informed people who work on computer simulations are now going to have a big argument over that. They're going to say, well, let's hope this doesn't catch on, because this is just dumb, right? Because it seems to miss the point, right? That's what would focus it. What's the killer question? And it's the sort of thing that you don't know it until it's all over. Right? What was the thing that you know? Because you'll take for granted that it goes.
And
well,
you want a killer question that really, like, polarizes, or that initial responses to it polarize.
Yes. And for sociological reasons in the field,
mm-hmm.
because that's what seems to completely energize a field,
mm-hmm.
and then everyone goes off and works really, really hard. And you have to get everything figured out, and you're highly motivated to get everything figured out now, because hell, you want your side to win on the killer question,
mm-hmm.
right? That's always been a very effective model for doing philosophy. find the thing that gets
yeah,
people.
Yeah, that's interesting, and the things that do occur.
Like, is causation a folk notion? Like, man, it gets everywhere. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Not even people like Jim Woodward and I who agree on it agree, right?
Mm-hmm. And you do want to inform people, as opposed to the ones that you, I mean, we do have quotes from people who are want to reject it because it's all virtual. You know, it's fact-free science.
Yeah.
But I don't think anybody who really, well, it sort of closes the box. Nobody who really uses it for scientific purposes thinks it's fact-free science.
Yeah, no. So, the question is, find another one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what it might be, but if you found it. All right, okay, that was mine. I'm sorry, it went on a bit long.
That was great, John. That's going to be very helpful.
Well, thanks for a great paper.
You haven't like broadsided it yet. I'm expecting the broadside.
No, I don't know.
I'm expecting, oh well, that's very well, but
could, you know, I was just thinking this, that last one, Patrick, could you see it as a pure, maybe instrumentalist position? You know, we're not claiming that there's any kind of isomorphism or correspondence going on with this. We just know that this model works in the past, and we hope it will in the future. I mean, I guess it would just be
instead of the interpretational, it's purely instrumental.
Yeah, I mean, if you're thinking of it like as an anti-realist position.
Well, and in this version, we have erased originally what's called the identity position. We called a realist position, and the interpretational position we called an anti-realist position. And then we thought, oh man, you know, don't stir the muck in the bucket. Just leave the muck in the bucket. You know, don't pour the bucket over your head. You don't have to. You know, and we weren't sure that this really was, you know, that we wanted to buy into that, or that was going to be at all helpful here. So we dropped the terminology, but we're looking for it.
Because I thought that's what you were going. But then when you got the interpretation, I'm like, does that mean like conventionalism? Like, this person interprets differently than I. I mean, how would that work for a simulation? That wouldn't make sense at all.
Yeah, you're saying it wouldn't work, and I agree it wouldn't work. And it was like sort of, oh, at the other extreme is going to be this. And then we wondered whether there really was anybody crazy who was going to take that.
But I got the instinct, though. The intuition. And that is, you can get simulations that use very, very different physical devices, yet somehow we humans are able to make the translation. I mean, think about someone using an abacus to do arithmetic.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. You know, a hell of a lot of the work's going on in the person's head. They're interpreting what the positions of the beads mean. So I think that's right. I remember once, it must have been 20 years ago, Tim Morland gave a paper which had the following trick to it. And, you know, this is actually, I hate to say it, it would be an example of your pure interpretation. I believe he was trying to make trouble for the computational theory of mind. And he was trying to devise an implementation of a Turing machine so that under your interpretation, it's doing nothing would be calculating whatever you want.
I know what you're talking about.
See the trick?
Yeah. And it is a problem for computational theories of mind. There are examples of, you know, oh, there might be like whirlwinds on the bottom of the ocean that if you read them a certain way were computing something.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, or the fact that they don't move at all.
Right.
The fact that you have perfect. That's it. So you can compute. You know, imagine a beam balance, and you put one mass here. There's the fulcrum, and you have a mass here and a mass here. That's in fact computing for you that one times this is equal to two times that plus three times that. You see, but actually nothing's happening.
Right.
Right? It's just sitting there, and so you're sort of saying it's computing. Mm-hmm. The idea is that all the work's being done, you know, nothing happens, the interpretation is doing all the work. That's still not a perfect example because you do indeed have that kind of equipoise, but still.
I'm moving on to a different question.
Okay.
You make these distinctions between prediction, explanation, and post-diction, and the way...
Should I say post-diction or retro-diction? Is there something that is... established
post-diction
there?
Post-diction, I think, used.
Retrodiction is used.
Post-diction is used, too.
Okay, all right.
Diagnosis?
What?
Diagnosis?
No.
Something different.
No, I like the parallel between diction. Pred and post. That's why I ended up post-diction.
So
but it could be pre and retro. So.
You actually discuss different epistemic... status of the prediction, simulation, explanation, and post-diction. And you seem to think that explanation and post-diction are a lot more troublesome than the case of prediction. Is that... that's the impression I got. And I was...
I don't think we want to say that.
But you seem to say that there is more problem...
There is a point at which we do say that.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to do with this modality. And I think that feeds into the fact that it's a sufficiency explanation,
yeah, yeah,
or we
yeah,
thought
yeah.
we did. So
for
that
the failure case problem. It comes later for the failure problem.
And it does come in with the failure problem. When people give simulation predictions, they at least tend to phrase the prediction in straightforward indicative form. You know, the storm will hit the Appalachians tomorrow. Okay, when they do the explanation ones, they tend to say, "Oh well, we've shown that this is a possible mechanism." Like even on when in the prejudice reduction model that we built. Okay. That's what we end up saying is, oh, look, you know, game theoretic advantage is a potential explanation for what's happening in the contact hypothesis. We don't say that's definitely what is happening, because there might be other things that produce the same effect. So we end up with this might modality, or this, you know, one among possibly many suggestions. And the same for the post-diction, because you end up saying, you know, oh, given the laws of the universe and the fact that there aren't any dinosaurs around, than a large body impacting the Yucatan at a particular date is a potential input condition that could explain.
And
you think that's not right?
No. It's fine. I'm in a way, prediction seems to give you more confidence, I guess, because you're saying, but. Even in the case of prediction, you can have completely false models.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And when it comes to the failure, that's when you'll know you've got one, is when you say, you know, it'll hit the Appalachians tomorrow, and it turns around and goes to Hawaii.
You might not have failure. I mean, that's the thing. You might not have failure. You might actually have correspondence between simulation prediction and the real case. But I will still say that your input or your mechanism might not correspond to reality.
I hope we don't say anything.
And I just simulate planetary system on the basis of Ptolemaic astronomy.
I hope we don't say anything contrary to that, because that's certainly right. Yeah, that of course you could mess up in those ways, and everything could look fine and not be fine.
I had the sense when.
But
I
that's thinking. That's not a problem with simulation.
But we don't want to say anything that makes somehow the prediction case sure and steady. The difference is that what you're doing is you're producing a set of input and mechanism conditions which will be sufficient for a particular output. Now, whether the input and mechanism matches the world, that's another question. But the whole structure of the whole simulation thing is to produce things that are sufficient for the output. And that, I think, does make a difference, because if you have something that, in showing that input and mechanism are sufficient for output, well, if they're really sufficient, then if you've got those, you've got it. That's what sufficient means. On the other hand,
and if you don't, you're going to say, well, something's wrong with my mechanism or input.
That's right. In the explanation case, to have an input and a mechanism are sufficient for an output, well, if you know the input and you know the output, knowing that the mechanism is sufficient for the output doesn't tell you that the mechanism obtains in the way that the sufficiency in the prediction does tell you that the output obtains. And similarly for the other one, that's the difference that we're trying to mark, but is not, absolutely. We don't want to claim that any of those check marks you're guaranteed that you're right about. No, you could be totally wrong about any of the check marks thinking that you've got that as corresponding with reality. Mm.
On this paragraph, it's part
Where is it?
A... of the third part on failures,
okay.
Page
23,
24.
Okay.
Oh, you read above and beyond the call.
Yes, she did. Thank you.
I did not pay attention. I was reading.
Maybe it was a mistake.
Thank you.
But that's what we're discussing right now.
Okay, great. So, which paragraph?
So at the very end, where you're discussing, you're showing the difference between explanation and post-diction precisely by saying that there is this modal qualification, that it doesn't tell you that the intended information missing, like mechanism in case of explanation or input in case of post-diction, must be the case, but
right.
It might be that it is. So,
right.
And you say, so what you're trying to show or to argue in this paragraph is that failure is possible for simulation, and that makes it relevant for the scientific practice, that the general idea. And you say at the end of the page 23, modal qualification does not, however, make failure impossible. In some cases, other evidence shows not only that things did not turn out a certain way, but that they couldn't have turned out in the way it was predicted that they might. So that's the decisive point if your general idea is to say that failure is possible for simulation, which makes it relevant for the scientific practice. But it seems to me that it's a little bit too quick. I mean, that either you give an example or you elaborate on this, because it's for the general point. I mean, there is the more specific point about the difference between prediction and explanation and post-diction in terms of modal qualification for the two lines.
And what we're saying in this paragraph, in particular, in this paragraph, is that. Up above, I've made the distinction that you were talking about between, oh, look, people tend to give predictions in terms of what will happen. With the explanation and the post-diction, they use this modality. This might have been the input. This might have been the mechanism. And then I say, well, sometimes they actually use that modality for prediction. But when they do that, it's a different kind of thing. They're saying, they're expressing a lack of confidence in their model itself. The only reason why sufficient conditions produce something that they say might happen is, well, they might be sufficient conditions. It's they might, you know, they're reflecting on the impropriety of their model. And it's true that at the end of that paragraph we go, but even if you do that, what I wanted to say is, even if you hedge your bets in any of these cases by saying, well, you know, this might have been the mechanism, or this might be what's going to happen, that makes it harder to press you for failure than if you just say this is what happened. On the other hand, I wanted to say it doesn't entirely remove you from the prospect of failure, because, and you're right, I should present some examples of cases where somebody goes, well, this might have been the mechanism, and somebody else is able to show that could not possibly have been the mechanism, in which case you fail even with the might claim.
Mm.
But you're right. An example there would be good. And I don't have one on the top of my head.
Well, I don't either, but I was expecting something. Yeah, I found it a little bit.
There was a case that I came across since I gave you guys this graph, which we'll probably put in, though I don't know quite where it's going to go in, which is a case of match. It's a case of emergent explanation that people have rejected as entirely implausible, and it was one of these early fractal images of a fern, where you've got a simple little function, you know, you iterate it, and you get this beautiful little drawing of, and not only does it look like a fern, it turns out to look like a particular kind of fern, all right? It's a spotwort fern, all right? And it was offered as sort of like, well, maybe this is the way nature does things. It's by calculating these, you know, these fractal geometries involved. But the objection was, well, if you go back and see how the function actually generates it, it like jumps from here to up here to here to here in an entirely biologically impossible way. No kind of development of any leaf could possibly follow that kind of algorithm. It would have to have grown half of its tip before it grew half of its base, you know? So, and that would be kind of case where you've got an output match, but it does not, in fact, tell you.
Yeah.
What does Wolfram think of this?
It seems like a straight counterexample to his kind of stuff, too. Yeah.
I don't know what Wolfram thinks. It came from someplace else.
So then, what's the
here
use?
Comes the broadside.
What's the use? I mean, of these emergent explanation thing. This 30% wish to be with people of the same color seems to be a similar case, right?
Well,
I mean, you see this, and you're still asking, well, what does it tell me? I don't understand why I see these groupings developing.
Well,
I don't understand what happens in nature. And
that's where some of the criticisms that's where some of the criticisms have come. When Schelling made the model, what he argued was, people tend to think that de facto housing segregation shows that we're all racists. Well, no, I'll show that that's not true, because there will be conditions that are weaker than we're all racists that produce it. There are other conditions that would be sufficient for that.
And how strong is the level of preference needed to produce that segregation? You told us, but I don't remember.
It's like 30%.
What does that mean? 30?
That means I want to live in a neighborhood with, at least 30% white guy.
So you go and you calculate to see if it's 30%, I stay.
No,
if it's 35, I move.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's right. That's exactly the way the model works. Yes. That's what the little agents do in the model.
Yeah. You just want a few people around you of like race.
Mm. Yeah. It doesn't have to be everybody. I don't care if we're in a minority, as long as it's, sort of a substantial minority. And you might not, the interesting thing about it is, you might not think that would be enough to give you de facto segregation, and it is. Now, Schelling's, that's where Schelling's claims stopped. That's all he ever said about the model, was, look, there might be other reasons you have de facto segregation that aren't a bunch of racists. It could be like this. Recently, people have looked at the model and said, well, if you make a stronger claim, if you're claiming not only that that's what might produce this pattern, but that is what actually produces something like that, something innocuous like that is what produces racial segregation in United States housing, well, we'll have to see whether the patterns of segregation look like the patterns that are on here, and we'll have to see whether the attitudes that people express on questionnaires look like this 30% thing. And it turns out, A, no, the patterns don't match the ones that appear up there very well. And not surprisingly, people don't answer questionnaires in terms of a 30% shutoff. You know, if they do express a preference, it's like, well, the more white guys there are around, the more I'll like it, you know, at least. Well, we want some diversity in there, okay, but, you know, and it's not a sharp cutoff. And then the criticism has gone back to Schelling's model and has shown that, no, it's crucial for that model to do what it does, that it's a 30% cutoff, that it's not, you know, oh, I'm getting increasingly unhappy as I get toward the 30%. No, it's got to be 29%, you know, or it's got to be at least 30%. 29%, I'm out of here. 31%, I love it here. You know, it's your little agents have to work that way, and that makes it, then you start worrying, well, it looks like that isn't such a great model. At least, you know, if it's being offered as something that is saying this is a potential mechanism for real segregation, well, it looks like that probably isn't a real mechanism for real segregation, or at least that's not the only mechanism, but there's something more refined or more complicated that's operating there. So that's the story with that.
But does that happen independently of what the starting parameter?
Yes.
But you just
randomize those guys. You randomize those. I mean,
and the only rule is if I have more than 30%.
It is possible to build an array where you don't have that. In other words, if you very carefully go, we'll put a white guy here and a red guy here and a green guy here.
That's an equilibrium. Everybody's satisfied.
It's possible to do that. Yes, it's possible to do that. However, if you start with just from a randomization of drop people where they land, you never get there. You have to so fine-tune the thing.
That's kind of plausible, because if you think about it, there's a kind of built-in instability. let's imagine you get, you know, a good mix of 33, 33, 33 in some neighborhood. People coming and going, right? And so it'll fluctuate a little bit. If ever the fluctuations take it over the threshold, that triggers a cascade, and off they go. So there's an inbuilt pseudo stability is built in. It's not a single point, but it's a region with boundaries that are going to be pseudo stable. Past that, and you're gone. So if you think about it, it's plausible. You still want to do the sums to, you know, do the simulation to see if it really goes that way. But
yeah, and you'd want to. People are more and more doing things where they want to have a better empirical input. So it'd be better if you're trying to explain segregated housing if you can get some simple model of your agents that you really are abstracting from questionnaire data, you know, and then put them into a situation and see if...
Well, the trouble, questionnaire data, that's...
Okay, yes. I know. But, it,
well, that's
but the idea is it might be better than no data, which is...
There is a passage on page 20, at the end of page 20 and 21. I'm somewhat confused. Where you say that in each of these cases it should be noted that there is crucial element of intentionality or epistemic purpose. A theory is proposed as targeting a particular phenomenon, and it's that intended phenomenon, not some other, that's used to measure its success or failure. That's, I mean, if you take theory as a set of propositions, regardless of the intentions of whoever put forward the theory, there is got to be some relation between the theory and whatever it is about.
Yeah, let me see what we say, and let me see if that's just not wrong. And speaking of the theory experiment.
Which page is that?
It's page 20, the last paragraph.
Yeah, that's not going to be right if you take a theory as a set of propositions, and the propositions have right built into them, that their target is a particular thing.
Yeah.
It would apply if you had a set of equations with T's and X's and P's, and you haven't told us yet what the T's, X's, and P's are going to be. That's one of those cases where, yeah, it's important whether it's, you know, do you just have a set of equations variables in them, or do you have a set of full-fledged claims about gravity, time, etc.? Which of those is the theory? And what you're pointing out is, if you take the latter, this is false, and we better fix that.
I'm thinking more about this killer question issue.
Yeah, give us one.
Yeah, no, indirectly. What are the people who specialize in simulation, what are they spending most of their time worrying about? You know, when you start in your field, you always think they're going to, you know, the hard part is going to be X. It never turns out to be. It's always something you never imagined.
There are a lot of people working in simulation who would like what this is like gesturing toward. They'd like a much more nicely formulated set of canons of experimental design. The same way that there are people in the social sciences who, you know, really have books on experimental design and books on the statistical analysis of data once you get it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it'd be nice to have those books for simulation.
And what are they going to get out of those books that they're not... I mean, these simulations were pretty great that you showed us. What are they going to get out of those books that they haven't got now?
It'd be nice... Well, here's what I think they would like to think they're going to get. They would like to have a validation measure. They would like to have something like, oh, this simulation or this model has been validated to 0.9 as opposed to this one that's only been validated to 0.2.
And what is validation?
Well, I don't know. That's what's going to be in the book, you know. But it's something good, you know. It's something you want your model to have, and it's something that has something to do with its reliability.
So it's like the power of a statistical test.
Yes, it's going to be something, yeah.
But you're announcing that you're going to give normative recommendation for appropriate measures of evaluation.
Yeah, I don't know whether we really do.
And you don't. When you read the paper
yeah,
at the end.
Yeah, I wish.
I was wondering, is it a
fathomatic
part? Or
Other than the, you've got to look for correspondence here, here, and here, and the particular kind of simulation you're doing, you're going to have to be open to criticisms of whether you've got artifacts that are coming in here, here, and here. We don't have anything sharper than that. That's what would be in the textbook, and you're right, we should not promise at the beginning that we've got anything sharper than that.
Okay. All right, so this worry about validation, is it different from the standard theoretician's worry? And that is, you can produce a theory that saves the phenomena, but, you know, do you have the right theory?
It's certainly going to be related to that.
If it's just the same, then it goes one way. But is there something, some new piece that comes in from the fact that it's a computer simulation? I mean, I can imagine one...
I think we're going to agree the answer is no.
Well,
that there's not, like, conceptually a new piece.
Well, but...
You
but there
is
that there's a new gap that opens up between input and output in that it's very hard to see where the output comes from sometimes, right? It just kind of happens, and I don't know if that's enough to, you know, if that's the difference that makes a big difference. I mean that's why you're simulating in the first place, because
mm-hmm.
you couldn't see your way through to what the result had to be. Which kind of suggests that the only way you can really do checks is by further simulation, right? Because that relation is somehow outside of your... I'm clutching at straws here. I'm trying to sort of build up... I'm trying to build that validation issue into...
Into the real thing it ought to be.
Well, if there's one there to be found, right?
Yeah, and I don't know whether there is or not. I think the one textbook on how to do simulations, I think that's probably silly. That's like the textbook on how to do science.
So people who are doing simulation, I thought that they will be worried, according to John's killer question, I thought that they will be worried about the gap between the output and the real world. That might be the biggest worry that they will have. Is it not the case?
The output or input and mechanism and output. I mean, that's the sort of first... off the seat of your pants killer question is, how can something that's fake tell you about something that's real?
Yeah, so
and simulation
that cannot
is
be
fake.
The killer question.
Well, that's the
one that everyone first walks into, and for me the answer is always the same. The epistemic issue is the same as an ordinary theorizing. You lay down what you know. The basic properties that you think govern the system, and then check if it's right. You know, so if DNA truly is the means that we transmit traits to our to the next generation, then you go and you do the tests. Two genetically identical twins should be physically identical, and sure enough, they turn out to be. It's the same thing. A simulation is a computer program that has basic statements in it that correspond to those sorts of laws. But maybe that it didn't seem so different.
It's
in the end.
Yeah, and that's of course the line we're trying to push.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe that means the killer question isn't so killer. Maybe.
Yeah. Now I've had. Just asking, what is it that people worry about? I've had different experiences with this. I don't do simulations, but I've done a little bit of numerical work. And the issue for me is that getting numerical algorithms to function properly is enormously harder than you ever dreamt. Two famous examples. One, a random number generator. A lot of these things have random number generators. You write down the obvious algorithm for doing a random number generator, and inevitably the thing is cycling well before your simulation is finished. So you're not getting random numbers at all. You're getting the same numbers back over and over again. It's quite a delicate business to get a good random number generator.
Now, I am interrupting you, but The kind of rubric that people use to judge random number generators. Oh, this one's better than that because, and they're like these benchmarks that you don't want your random number generator to do. That's sort of like, that's what they'd like the textbook on simulations to do.
Yeah, that's what I was expecting to be in there. Second problem, very often in numerical work you want to invert a matrix, and that turns out to be one hell of a nasty business. The Cramer rule is an exponential rule. So if you got a 4x4 matrix, no problem. But if you got a 20x20 matrix or a 50x50 matrix, the fact that it's an exponential algorithm
kills you.
It just kills your computation. So you've got to use the Gauss elimination method. And even then, you can get into trouble. There's a thing called the Hilbert matrix, which has been craftily designed so that if you use standard numerical methods on it, the errors propagate so rapidly that you get nonsense results out if you're not extremely careful. But this is the thing that struck me over and over again whenever I was looking at numerical methods, how incredibly hard it was to get anything to work. Or, you know, solving differential equations, got to be very, very careful. I was actually trying to do this a while ago, now that I think about it. I was trying to get a digital solution of some differential equations where I knew the result would be non-analytic, right? And I was just using a standard package, and I could see it was really struggling with the fact that these equations were not analytic, right?
Well, I think that's true, that there are critics of simulation who have never done any of it, who go, well, you can get anything you want by, you know, tweaking parameters. Yeah, you just try to get anything you want. It's just not true.
I was just thinking about that comment. I mean, just to give some sense what those people are trying to do. Maybe, so when, suppose you are trying to predict something and you failed in computer simulation. I think there is this intuition that since this is all the parameters in computer, you can fix whatever you want and accommodate the data. But in the real case, it will be more harder. The intuition they have. So.
In the real case as opposed to the
computer simulation.
Well,
so if you are doing a real experiment in the lab, it's not as easy to play with things. There are going to be more constraints. But if it is computer program, you can just change
but that's
things
not what
you want.
Yeah,
maybe that's the intuition they have. So when there is a failure, you won't be doing justice.
Maybe. It seems like that's running two things together. One is, yes, it's true of computer simulations that they are a lot cheaper than real experiments with, like, you know, subjects in a lab or something, and you can do zillions of them. So in that way, yeah, it's easier, but that doesn't mean that getting things to produce a result that, you know, matches something real, no... It's no easier than getting a theory of something real.
So what type of evidence is it?
What kind of evidence? Of which part? Of the real?
The simulation part.
What kind of evidence does the simulation give you, you mean?
Yeah.
I think always what they give you is a set of sufficient conditions. If they are successful, they're giving you a set of sufficient conditions for a particular observed outcome. Yes. One thing we left out of here, which I think is worth thinking about, but we didn't want to bite all the bullets at the same time, was whether, and maybe this is a way of approaching the killer question or making the killer question killer, is can you confirm a theory with simulation?
That
confirmation wasn't one of our, you know, and there is, you know, I think everybody has a little resistance to that. Well.